Hej och välkomna till avsnitt 1203 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, Sveriges enda konservativa USA-podd med mig, Ronny Berggren, som kan stödjas på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0. I detta avsnitt intervjuar min kollega John Gustafsson, en av de centrala gestalterna i den konservativa Never Trump-rörelsen, Bill Kristol, son till neokonservatismens gudfader Irving Kristol och grundare av den nu nedlagda tidskriften The Weekly Standard och numera redaktör för nättidningen The Boulevard, där man vill analysera amerikansk politik utan den trumpism som man menar numera i övrigt dominerar det republikanska partiet. Varmt välkomna.
Okay, Bill Kristol, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, it's a great having you here. So I'm just gonna start off. You've been in the magazine business for a while now. So can you tell us about your latest project, The Bulwark?
So I was one of the founders of the Weekly Standard, which was a print magazine and also a website, of course, that began way back. Back in 1995, it was closed by our owners in 2018, I think, unfortunately, since we were doing fine, but they were pro-Trump and we weren't, and they used other excuses, but that was the true reason. So we started, my colleague, I'm just an editor at large, really, play a minor role, but my colleague, Jonathan Last, with whom I'd worked at the Standard for two decades, started The Bulwark, which is a website. People should go look at it, thebulwark.com. Very simple, three or four articles a day, anti-Trump, but mostly conservatives who have been anti-Trump, and not just about Trump, but about American politics and the future of the Republican Party, the future of conservative ideas. I think it's been successful. A lot of people seem to go to it and read it. We've attracted a lot of good new writers, younger writers, people like you,
Swedish
people from
writers.
Abroad. What, Swedish writers? I think you might be. Yeah, there are only a couple of you, but it's been one of the great things about it is that because we're welcoming to people and it's not a well-established brand and it doesn't intimidate people, I suppose. I'm very encouraged by the number of people who are interested in saving a kind of healthy, I don't know what to call it, liberal conservatism or conservative liberalism or commitment to liberal democracy and avoiding the kind of nationalist populism on the right, but also kind of cancel culture on the left. So it's been an encouraging couple of years in that respect for me.
You're also involved with a project called Republican Voters Against Trump. I understand you've been doing a lot of billboards recently. What's that all about?
So with that, the insight I think behind that is that voters don't trust the elite media very much. They don't trust slickly produced advertisements made by media consultants in Washington or New York or LA. But they do respond to voters like themselves. And so we, having done various other efforts in our group Defending Democracy Together over two, 3 years, had a list of Republicans who were against Trump in various ways. And we simply asked them, do you want to make a video on your iPhone, a couple of minutes, explaining that why you're a Republican who's against Trump? And different people, many of them voted for Trump in 2016, some didn't. They're all types, it turned out, and we've gotten a big response, and it's gotten a lot of publicity, and we've actually been able to raise money and spend money to publicize some of these videos, and they're all available on the website if you go to Republican Voters Against Trump. And it's been effective. I think a lot of the studies, the professionals look at it, and they think, well, if you get a slickly produced ad, as I say, voters don't believe that, but if it's someone like you, someone who says, look, I'm a voter in Michigan and I voted for Trump. I thought I had hopes that he would shake things up in 2016, that he would grow into office, but he hasn't. Or I'm a veteran in Florida or a senior citizen in Pennsylvania, and here's what led me to really come out against Trump. So there's a wide variety of people. It's been interesting to see the variety of types in America, honestly. Some of them are quite moving. Some of them are, this is the first Democrat they'll be voting for in 30 years, 50 years. People were moved by different issues, I would say. Mostly it's about Trump's character, but some people were most offended by his waving the Bible around a few months ago. Some people by the management of COVID, mismanagement of COVID, obviously. Other issues, the disrespect for veterans. So it's been an interesting effort. I think we've We've done pretty well, honestly. We now have three or four Trump administration officials who've left and done videos, and those have gotten quite a lot of attention. And so explaining why they felt they had to leave after months and years of trying to make the best of the situation they were faced as professionals in the Trump administration and the Trump White House. So that's been an interesting effort. Most Republicans are for Trump. I don't want to fool anyone, but probably 88-90%. But obviously in a close election, if you lose 10% of Republicans instead of 4 or 5%, that's a huge difference.
Yeah. So the last week on this podcast, I interviewed Rick Wilson of the Lincoln Project. Their style is a little bit more aggressive than yours, from what what I understand. So how coordinated are Never Trumpers? Because you have, you know, the RVAT, the Boulevard, the Dispatch, the Lincoln Project, lots of independent voices as well, of course. How much... are you independent actors, or are you conspiring together?
I'd say we're independent actors. Many of us know each other, and we're friendly, and there's no rule or law against coordinating at times, and there are times we have coordinated. But I think each of us is in our own, more on parallel paths than totally coordinated. Our theory of the case is that these ordinary voters making their case more in sorrow than in anger, really, is the way to move swing voters. The Lincoln Project has done some terrific ads, but they're more, I'd say, trying to annoy Trump and preaching to the choir and energizing anti-Trump voices and voters, which is important as well. And then there are obviously the Bulwark is a website. It's more intellectual, you might say. Dispatch is a new website edited by my friend Steve Hayes, and that's also complimentary. A little, their style is to be a little more post-Trump and not never Trump. So everyone's got their own little takes on what it means to oppose Trump, what it means to be a conservative in 2020. And, you know, people sometimes say to me, oh, there's, you know, it's confusing. There are differences among never Trumpers. And I say, absolutely, it's a free country. Now, it would be kind of crazy if we all came up with the exact same conclusion as to how to oppose Trump, or as to where the conservative movement is going to go, or whether the Republican Party is salvageable. We don't all agree among ourselves, our little group, even of Republican voters against Trump. So I think it's a healthy discourse, a healthy debate, really, among anti-Trump Republicans, conservatives, moderates, people who don't want to simply embrace the left, but certainly can't tolerate Trump.
So you mentioned the Dispatch being, you know, more focused on the post-Trump. So this leads me actually quite nicely to my next question. So will the Bulwark be around after the election? You know, provided Trump loses, Trump is gone, is the Bulwark still around?
Yes. I mean, in fact, we just made a pitch or an appeal to our readers and to explain that while the Bulwark will continue to be free, the website will be free, no ads, no subscription. If you want to get some of the additional things, the newsletters and some of the podcasts, we'll ask you now to pay, because obviously you can't produce this for free. And we've gotten a terrific response. And the whole point of that, and several hundred thousand dollars, and the whole point of that is to make sure the Bulwark can keep going, will keep going, and will keep going in a strong way, as Trump might say, after Trump. Okay. Because there really is an important discussion now to be had about various issues, the broader question of the Republican Party, conservatism, liberalism, liberal democracy. So we're very much looking forward to playing a role in that discussion.
Just so you know, I did sign up for a subscription.
Excellent. Good. Okay. Yeah.
I kind of felt that I should have gotten it for free, but you know, never mind. I'm not offended.
It's called the free market. It's called capitalism. You know.
Yeah, I was willing to pay it, so you charged it. Moving on. So I guess this is a question I've been asking myself a lot of times, and I also asked it of Rick Wilson last week. How did we get here? Like, what in your view, what were the key mistakes that, you know, if you had undone, if they could have been undone, that could have prevented Trump, if they could have prevented this path that led here?
I mean, it's of course a very important question, and a lot of people have discussed it, and there are aspects of conservatism and the Republican Party that perhaps we should have fought harder against, that we did fight pretty hard against, and that's what's sort of slightly disconcerting. It's not as if a lot of us didn't fight Pat Buchanan and didn't fight Ron Paul, didn't fight isolationism, didn't fight protectionism, but we did, and incidentally, we did so quite successfully. The Republican Party beat back all these aspects of a different kind of conservatism for decades, really. Now, maybe that was all just buying time and eventually it was going to break through. I mean, I would say this. I don't think Trump himself is that would necessarily require that much rethinking. That is, Trump, he won the nomination in a multi-candidate race. He was lucky in some of his opponents. He was a good demagogue. Terrorism seemed to be exploding. We had the bombings and the attacks in Paris, and then we had attacks here in San Bernardino. And, you know, he got lucky, frankly, and exploited all that and got the nomination. Then he faced a weak general election candidate, Hillary Clinton, and defeated her very, very narrowly. So that can happen, right? You have a democratic system, big country, lots of things happen, and a person who really shouldn't be president, shouldn't be the nominee, becomes the nominee, and a person who shouldn't be president becomes the president. It's not good, but it can happen. For me, though, the real indicator that your question needs to be taken seriously is look at the behavior of the Republican Party and of conservative elites. And it's been so disgraceful since Trump became president that you do wonder how much all this talk about the rule of law and deficits and markets and American leadership was just talk. And it was all tribalism. It was all about, I guess, hating the left. It was all about resentments and anxieties. And Trump has exploited those well. But again, it's one thing for Trump to exploit them. It's another for people to be willingly exploited. And I'm not talking so much about the base. You know, there are a lot of people out there. And it's always been the case in a big modern democracy and in ancient democracies, too, that the demagoguery can work. And people are unhappy and they have economic questions and they have problems and they have cultural anxieties and they dislike some of their fellow Americans, and so they could be, that could all be exploited. But for the Republican elected officials, who after all in our system are elected independently, they're elected from states and from congressional districts, and for conservative elites, both journalistic and business elites, to just capitulate the way they have shows a kind of weakness and almost hollowness, emptiness, that does make you wonder about the whole conservative movement and the Republican Party. I don't think it was always that way, but it is worth just stressing how unusual that is. I was in the first Bush White House. I followed the second Bush White House very closely. Republican senators and congressmen had no problem expressing opposition to a Republican president on many issues. I was one of those who helped lead the fight against Harriet Myers when George W. Bush nominated her for the Supreme Court in 2005, and he withdrew her after a month. There was so much willingness among conservatives to say, look, we want a better qualified nominee, not someone who happens to be your personal lawyer, your personal White House counsel. And it was nothing personal against her. It was just that she wasn't really of the stature to be a Supreme Court judge, we thought. But again, people didn't, I mean, of course, people criticized us. How could you oppose the president? But no one, it was considered, that's how American politics is. That's how politics is in most countries in a healthy democracy. The kind of just sycophancy to Trump and the capitulation to Trump, that has shown a kind of rot, a kind of real problem, I think, with the conservative movement and the Republican Party.
Yeah, it's interesting because you have individually elected congressmen and senators, you know, they're elected on their own mandate. And that's what surprised me so much, because, of course, in Sweden, you know, we have a list system. So you don't have a personal mandate as an MP. You're there as a representative for your party, not your district, not your voters, other than the party's voters. And if the party leadership doesn't like you, then you're not going to be on the list in the next election. And then it makes sense in a way, even though I can think that Swedish MPs are too subservient, but I understand, you know, the mathematics of it at least. Whereas with Trump, you know, people should be able to use their own political mandate to stand up to him. And that
yeah, I know. This is, I mean, political scientists, political theorists have thought about this a long, long time. And one of the strengths and weaknesses of a presidential system or an independent electoral system as Britain has, where each MP runs in his own district, is that presumably you have a kind of independence. One of the, it can be a strength or a weakness, and obviously there's some strengths to having a parliamentary system with a list like Sweden or Germany or Israel, many places, where you get a kind of more cohesive, presumably, party that can govern. Now, if you have 15 parties, then it's a cohesive party that can go into a coalition with other parties.
Yeah, so if then you have a majority of one, then you govern the country. It's literally like that.
Yeah, but I mean, one of the strengths, I would say, of our separation of powers system has always been thought to be that ambition will counteract ambition. It's good for liberty. It checks the executive branch to have a Congress independently elected and with the power to legislate and obviously to appropriate funds and to have oversight of the executive. And that's all collapsed in a very discouraging way.
So back in 2016, we were talking about magazines, so let's talk about another one. Back in 2016, the National Review, which is another conservative magazine, I'm just saying that for the Swedish listeners who might not know, they ran an entire issue dedicated to attacking Donald Trump, explaining why he was unsuitable to be the Republican nominee and suitable for the presidency. And they held a stand for some time after the election as well, but I feel like the past 2 years they folded and and so were many other former Trump critics like Eric Erickson and Ben Shapiro, whom I know Eric Erickson contributed to that special edition issue. So why is that? Is this due to them genuinely changing their conviction, or is it financial reasons, or what is it?
Yeah, I mean, I contributed to that issue too, so it was a good issue. It stands up well, actually, if you read it. But so I think it's a combination of things. There's some opportunism and some cynicism, but I think more a kind of accommodation to reality. I mean, people didn't expect him to win the nomination. They certainly didn't expect him to win the presidency. So there was a sense that you say never Trump, and then Trump loses, and then you say, okay, time for some fresh thinking. Once Trump wins the presidency in America, it's obviously very powerful. It's a 4-year term. You control the entire executive branch. And you tell yourself, if you're an outsider, if you're a journalist, if you're an activist, if you're a professor or a columnist or a businessman, you say, you know, I care about the Supreme Court, or I care about the tax code, or I care just more prosaically about having friends and colleagues in the executive branch. It's good for them. It's good for the country. I like my friends, you know. And so you tell yourself that let's try to get along with Trump. And I can see that at the beginning. I don't really begrudge people the day after election day saying, look, let's have an open mind about how he actually behaves as president. I would say by the end of the transition, January 20th, it was pretty clear how he was going to behave. But again, if people wanted to hope that once he settled into the Oval Office, once he understood the magnitude of his task and his responsibilities, that he would change, I can see that. Then in his first couple of years, he behaves very badly in many ways. But he does have people around him who are serious people and who constrain him. And you could argue that, again, it wasn't as bad as people thought it might be, that there were guardrails, that we could tolerate him if we got some policies and appointments and changes in direction for the country that were, as people thought, worthwhile. How people can sustain that in the third year or the fourth year, when clearly the guardrails are gone, when he's fired or forced to leave most of the decent people in the government, when he's more and more reckless, and when we now see the price with COVID of a kind of just incompetence and self-deception and lying, that I do find pretty amazing. But I suppose once people dig in, once they make their, you know, it's like sunk costs and economics, once you make your investment, it's hard to tell yourself that, gee, I was wrong. I respect very much the people who say I did my best, but now it's too much. I can't take it anymore. What's amazing is how few of those people there are. And time after time, they've had a chance to break with Trump, whether they're elected officials, whether they're National Review, Wall Street Journal editorial page. And they haven't really. I mean, they've complained about certain things, but they haven't really broken. And they want to reelect him. And for me, that's a huge thing. It's one thing to say, oh, I don't like the left. He's better than you think. I'm going to work with the administration in practical ways, try to influence them. I don't have much problem with that. I think it's unwise in this case, but, you know, they're better off being in opposition. But I understand that. That's like in the 30s being in Britain and saying, you know, if I can push the Chamberlain government to do more of a defense buildup, it's worth it, even though I don't approve of his overall foreign policy. And a lot of decent people stayed in. But they finally left. You know, they finally quit. Duff Cooper and Anthony Eden and et al. Quit in 38 and 39 because it was intolerable. Now, that doesn't mean everyone should quit, incidentally. If you can help public health despite what Trump's doing, if you can keep our military strong and keep our foreign policy sort of on course, I have no problem with people staying in the Defense Department or in the CDC or in the health organizations or in the State Department and so forth. But it's become increasingly difficult to defend all this. But what's amazing is the degree to which these conservative elites haven't broken. They aren't willing to say, you know what, I think we did some pretty good things in these 4 years, but not another term. And for me, that's the key. The fact that they're willing to support him for re-election with everything that's happened just is a kind of capitulation that I can't really stomach. And it does make me, therefore, wonder about the future. It's had a big effect, incidentally, though. I would say for your listeners in Sweden and elsewhere, you know, everyone focuses on the Trump base, the populist appeals. They look at the rallies, and those are pretty astonishing, perhaps. But none of that would have happened without the collaboration, really, of the Republican elected officials and the conservative elites. You know, you can have all the base you want, but if Republican senators say, I'm sorry, we're not passing this, or if conservative editorial writers even say, no, this is too far, that would have a real effect. But the capitulation of the elites has been really striking.
It's interesting you mentioned sunk cost fallacy, because I'm actually a behavioral economist, so I've studied that. And I think also I also think there's a measure sort of cognitive dissonance where people start off defending him not genuinely, but you have to sort of make your actions go with your beliefs sooner or later. So you have to adjust one or the other, either stop defending him or start genuinely believing. And it's incredible what the mind can do. And I think that's one of the smart things that Trump was actually counted on. He's not as smart as he thinks he is, but he understood a lot of that psychology, quite frankly. If you can get people to hang on for long enough, then it's hard to get off.
I think that's very shrewd. I wish more people here understood that. Look, he's a bit of con man in business. Sometimes legal, sometimes stretching the edges of the law, but it's all been a big, big con. It was all about the brand and the, you know, lying about the quality of his hotels and of his products. But you understand, if you're a con man, that often if you can get people invested, they stay with you. They don't simply turn away because they don't want to admit they've been conned, right? This was the key to Bernie Madoff, the key to a lot of these swindles and Ponzi schemes and so forth. So he has a certain understanding of how to con people, to use that term. He also has a certain understanding that demagogues tend to have of how to keep people invested, so to speak. I mean, it's not, you know, you don't make it about real results. You don't make it about our manufacturing jobs actually coming back to Ohio. No, it's about who you're fighting and who you're denouncing and who you're what issues you're exploiting, what anxieties and grievances you're exploiting. And people stop asking, well, what's really happening? I mean, what about reality? Is it actually better? Now, this is where COVID, I think, you know, the U.S. is a strong country. The economy chugged along in the recovery. And it was a little hard to prove that Trump was doing huge damage. I think he was doing a lot of damage beneath the surface to our international leadership, to free markets and so forth. But, you know, you couldn't really prove that. This is where COVID has been so important, because there you just have a case study. Okay, this is just, no one doubts that the federal government is fundamentally important in dealing with a pandemic. It's a, you know, study of just of competence and of being serious about something. And he's failed that.
I agree completely. So I understand that since 2 years ago, you're no longer a registered Republican. Is that correct?
Well, in Virginia, so we have different rules in each state, and in Virginia, you don't register by party. But I haven't really voted for a Republican in a couple of years, because I do think the whole party has become so complicit in Trump and Trumpism. I could pretty easily see in 2022 or 2024, you know, if there's a Republican I prefer to a Democrat, and that Republican he doesn't have to be where I am. He doesn't have to denounce Trump all the time, but he needs to make clear that that's not his vision or her vision for the future of the Republican Party. I can certainly imagine voting for a conservative or a Republican, but there I think it's very much up in the air. I mean, is there a, what, how do we get to a Republican Party that's liberated from Trump and Trumpism?
That's actually what I was going to ask, if you saw yourself being involved in the in 2024 in the primary election for president.
I don't know. You know, I think my first obligation, not my first obligation, but I think what I feel I should do after the election, first of all, is I will vote for Biden, and I wish him well. He'll be our president. You know, he's shown a willingness to work in a bipartisan way, and I think people like me have some obligation to suggest to him what would be better policy, what would be worse policy, understanding that he'll be more liberal than we would want in any case. But it makes a big difference if it's a kind of Bill Clinton liberalism or Elizabeth Warren liberalism. And certainly in many, many areas of foreign policy, Bill Clinton's foreign policy wasn't that different from George H.W. Bush's. And, you know, if, in terms of fairly strong belief in a Europe whole and free, some standing up to Russia is different, obviously, with Yeltsin. But anyway, without getting into every issue, one can I do think we people like me might have some chance to very much on the margin, perhaps, influence the Biden administration in a couple of areas. So I would like to I think we have some obligation to try to do that rather than right away think about the opposition party. Having said that, I also have a big interest in a great interest in what kind of opposition party we have in the U.S. And I think it's much, much healthier to have a market-oriented, American leadership-oriented, non-nativist conservative party in opposition than a Trumpy opposition party. But I'm worried. I do think that the Trump people will simply pivot to screaming and yelling about how horrible Biden is. They'll denounce, of course, people like me for stabbing Trump in the back. And I'm not so optimistic about the Republican Party coming back to sanity in the very near future.
Hmm. No, I hope you're wrong, but I fear you may be right about that. I was actually thinking the entire primary system may have to change in order to allow a non-extremist. Because there's been a similar thing happening in the UK Labour Party, as you may know, a few years ago when Jeremy Corbyn took over the party with basically a core of rather extreme members who were not representative of the party's voters. I was actually thinking, instead of primary debates, maybe next time you guys can just play Jeopardy. I think that would be a better way to find out who's competent, you know.
Yeah, no, totally.
I'll take stuff the president cannot do for 600.
That's a good idea. I'll suggest you should write that up for the Bulwark. I'd say, let me just two things. I think the Corbyn example is very interesting. So on the one hand, someone said to me a couple of weeks ago, well, look, Labour seems to have pivoted away from Corbyn pretty quickly now that he's gone. And it looks more like the traditional Labour Party. And I'm not a Labour person, but you know, it's a respectable party committed to liberal democracy and so forth. But Corbyn was never prime minister. That's the big difference. If Trump had been a candidate who lost in 2016, I think there wouldn't have been a big deal in repudiating Trump and Trumpism. Very different after 4 years of rationalizing and supporting him. So that for me is an interesting question. How much is the Labour model appropriate to the British labor model transferable here? I do think we need to rethink the electoral system. You know, a lot of things need to be rethought, how Congress works, how the party system works, the electoral system. I'm very much open, more than I was 10 years ago, to pretty big changes because the system hasn't worked well. And it wasn't working well before Trump in many, many ways. It was working better than people think in other ways, frankly. People overdo how broken everything was. But nonetheless, post-Trump, I do think we need some real consideration of reforms of various kinds. And that'll be an interesting thing for all of us to participate in, a good debate to be part of at the Bulwark and elsewhere.
So, according to Wikipedia, and yes, I looked you up, and according to Wikipedia, you are the godfather of neoconservatism. And so naturally I have to ask, does neoconservatism have a future?
So I think my father really was the godfather of neoconservatism, but I so neoconservatism was a reaction
to... You have to correct Wikipedia. I'm just quoting.
Exactly. Well, I never bother looking at my own entry in Wikipedia, though it's normally, I agree, it's a pretty reliable source, I've got to say, more than people think, often, I mean, for facts. Anyway, neoconservatism was a very reasonable and important, I think, reaction against liberalism going off the rails a little bit in the late 60s and early 70s, both in terms of foreign policy, failure to really stand up to the Soviet Union, in terms of the understanding of the importance of markets, in terms of a kind of accommodation to the new left and inability to stand up to them. And so neoconservatism started off as that, and it became part of the conservative coalition that elected Ronald Reagan. And I think very much similar things happened in Europe. And of course, Thatcher was a major figure, and but many others as well. And obviously, the reform of the welfare system, which Sweden did a lot of in the 90s, and a lot of that was based on a kind of neoconservative policy critique of you can't just spend money foolishly and so forth. Whether, it's an honest question, and I really don't know. So I think the neoconservative impulse remains. Or persuasion, as my father said, remains strong and very, very valuable. Liberalism needs a correction occasionally in the direction of a kind of appreciation of certain conservative truths, if you want to put it that way. On the other hand, liberalism also needs to be defended against the left and against a kind of populist nativist conservatism, which was always very far from neoconservatism. And I guess now I'm more inclined to think about defending liberalism than about the critique of liberalism, though the critique is an important part of the defense, if you know what I mean. So it's an interesting moment. I would say for younger people, I think in terms of political philosophy, which was my field, in terms of economics as well, thinking through the kinds of policies that are appropriate in the 21st century, the general attitude one should have towards antitrust and economic concentration and innovation. I do think too much of the left critique ignores the incredible value, for example, of innovation, and if the price you pay for that is greater inequality to some degree, it may well be worth it because you get a huge amount of public goods out of technological breakthroughs and people making a lot of people having great incentives and venture capital having great incentives to invest in those breakthroughs and so forth. Having said all that, there's also a problem with new monopolies and with excessive inequalities. So I think I'm sort of for fresh thinking across the board at this point. Which was what neoconservatives tried to do in the 70s. So it's another moment for fresh thinking.
So, like I mentioned when I chatted to you before we started this podcast, the host of this podcast is actually a Trump supporter. We're good friends, which is why I'm still allowed to be on. But he's also contradictory. He's also someone who calls himself a neoconservative and who is also a big fan of yours.
Wow.
But his case for Trump is basically that Trumpist isolationism is needed for the US to take a break, to take a breather, so to speak, from foreign policy intervention. That the isolationism is, a necessary evil, even if it's not desirable in the long term. Could you please tell him why he's wrong?
I should probably go in a few minutes. So why don't we make this? This is a good conclusion. So look, I think there are versions of mild Trumpism, let's put it this way, that are reasonable. Yes, maybe you could take a break. I'm not so certain. I think we did take kind of a break during the Obama years, frankly, and that didn't work out so well. Ask the Syrians and ask the Europeans who dealt with the refugee crisis. That's one thing that has produced the kind of populism and xenophobia that we see today. But whatever, I can see a mild version of no, we need to be a little more constrained in foreign policy. We need to care more about working class who are disadvantaged by modern, by the disproportionate rewards that now go to education and to into the upper middle class, to the wealthy. A lot of those things, immigration is, of course, a complicated issue, and there are some legitimate arguments against simply throwing the gates open. Not that we've done that, but so there are legitimate versions of this. But that is, I think it's a huge mistake to say that, therefore, I'm going to support Trump. And that's, I think people just underestimate the damage that's being done to the fundamental constitutional system, to liberal democracy, and to the things that your friend cares about. Markets are weaker today than they were 4 years ago. The case for markets, the allegiance to free markets, because of Trump. If you are a 20-year-old in America and you look, this is your educational moment the last 4 years, the people who talk the most about markets, tax cuts, and so forth, don't believe in markets. It's all crony capitalism. They don't believe in actual tax cuts to spur the economy. They believe in rewarding their friends. They don't believe in American leadership in the world. They believe in attacking our allies and cozying up to dictators. How can that be a useful break to praise Kim Jong-un and Un and Putin and Xi, for that matter, and to say nothing about democracy, nothing about Hong Kong, nothing about Belarus? I mean, that is not a useful break. That is a reversal, and it's a damaging reversal. And so I'd say all the people who have talked themselves into thinking that Trump is what they would like to be, if Trump were what they wanted, yes, I wouldn't be as upset about Trump. I've always said that. None of the individual policies by itself in moderation is, I might oppose them, but they're not horrible, you know. I mean, a little bit of tariffs, a little bit of withdrawal perhaps from places where we're overextended. But that's not what Trump is about. That is not what Trump's about. And the proof is in, look around America. That's not what's happening. It's not a sensible recalibration. It's a crazed kind of incitement of populist anxieties and resentments in a way that's very damaging over the not just the long term, but I'd say in the short term. So I very much think I think people can talk themselves into believing that Trump is the equivalent of, I don't know enough about Swedish politics, but sort of a moderate conservative politician who just kind of checks things for a few years and then until we get back on the horse, you know, or Harold Macmillan in England or something like that. But that is not what Trump is. And it's a big mistake to see Trumpism that way. Trump is authoritarianism. It is a kind of nasty nativist populism. And it doesn't lead to a healthy check on the excesses of the left. It strengthens the left. Is the left's cancel culture stronger today than it was 4 years ago? Absolutely. Why? Because in the academy, if you try to say, wait a second, we have to have a healthy debate, people say, well, that's just a cover for Trump. And who wants that, you know, and that kind of intolerance. So if you are a serious conservative in terms of liberal education, in terms of free markets, in terms of American leadership in the world, you should be against Trump.
Thank you very much, Bill Kristol. It was a great honor to have you on the podcast. And
my pleasure.
And
good luck,
look forward to contributing to the Bulwark.
Well, yeah, please keep on contributing. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Det var avsnitt 1203 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, en konservativ podcast som drivs för att ge det perspektiv på USA som svensk media inte ger. Stöd mottages tacksamt på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0 eller genom att via hemsidan stödja på PayPal, Patreon eller bankkonto. För er som är mer nyfikna på Never Trump-rörelsen rekommenderas även Jon Gustafssons intervju i poddavsnitt 1198 med Rick Wilson, en av grundarna bakom anti-Trump-organisationen The Lincoln Project. Det var allt för idag. Tack för att ni har lyssnat. Thank you.